Thank you very much for being here so early in the morning. This is joint work with Ufuk Acicic and Sina Hades. It's a long project. It took us almost 5 years to get here, but we're almost done. And it's going to be, again, on trade and innovation, with an emphasis on both trade policy and innovation policy. So on the x-axis you see the growth rate of patenting. This is, I'm going to start with a little bit of descriptive evidence, and on the right axis you see productivity growth. So this is the late 60s, and you see that U.S. seem to lag compared to other advanced economies patenting, and this lag in patenting seems to be connected to lagging productivity growth. So this, I recall that this was a period where there was a big discussion in U.S. Policy circus about U.S. losing the technological leadership, okay? So policymakers were worried about Japan and European countries recovering from the war and catching up with US technology. The same way now we start being worried about China as a technological competitor, although they're still quite far away. So this you can find in the history of technology policy literature tons of quotations like this. So these industries, so the high tech industry, are dominated by few nations and few firms, so that competitive advantage brings significant economic profits and political influence. Don't forget that this was the period where still you see the last bit of the Cold War going on, and so you still have the strategic military concerns about military leadership mixing up with the new concerns about economic leadership. Thus, if the United States becomes a net importer and a technological inferior producer, it would also become less independent, less influenced, and a less secure nation. Okay, so to give you a dig deeper into data, the blue line is the foreign share of patents, okay, the share of patents patented by foreign firms in the US Patent Office over total patent. And the red line is citations. As you can see, foreign patents, so at the late 60s, most patents in the US Patent Office are American, and then you see this catching up of foreign firms. This is mostly Japan, Germany, and France. And the same thing you see in citations. Later on, I'm going to break it down, this data, into patent classes, into sectors, and you see that within each sector you see this convergence as well. Okay, and then the convergence stops in the mid-80s, and you see a reversion of trend. Okay, so sort of a comeback of U.S. patenting. You do this with triadic data, triadic patents, you see a similar pattern. So, because of those discussions, those concerns, in the 80s, a lot of new policies were introduced in the US, aimed at improving American firms' competitiveness. Okay? So in 1981, there was the introduction of the R&D tax credit at the federal level. In 82, starting with Minnesota, there was the introduction of state-level credits. We're going to focus on these policies, okay, as a policy response to increasing foreign technological competition. And we're going to assess the welfare effects of these policies. In those years, so R&D tax credit is just a piece of a wider plan that the U.S. government had to improve their firm's competitiveness in global innovation races. So other policy tools were the IPR protections, like the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980 that allowed a university to patent. A lot of technology transfer acts, mostly aimed at small firms. They could not innovate by themselves. So imagine this is a world where there is a huge pool of public technology, mostly military technology, okay? And these sort of policies were aimed at helping small firms fishing in that pool of public technologies and innovating commercially. There's also demand pool policies, market size policies, mostly through the big agencies. Department of Defense, NASA, etc. So some data on R&D subsidies. So the beans are the number of states that have implemented the subsidy at each year, and you see the red line is the effective tax credit rate at the state level. You see that it increases, it's an average here, it increases and it plateaus around 6%. This is data from Wilson. So here we've taken some previous work by Rachel and redone some calculation on it. This is the effective rate of R&D tax credit at the federal level, of tax credit at the federal level. And you see that the R&D tax credit in the United States jumps because of the introduction of the research and experimentation tax credit in 81. And then there is another jump in 89 because it changes the basis for getting the credit. So this is an incremental credit, okay? It gives you a tax credit over an average over on the additional R&D that you do on top, in addition of the average, for example, past 3 years, okay? So you see that the other countries, they have tax credits, okay, but they don't. These credits don't move much in those years we are looking at. So again, descriptive evidence. The dotted line it shows the share of U.S. patents in U.S. Patent Office. You see. The same image that I showed at the beginning, this convergence of foreign patents. So you see the decline in U.S. patenting, and then you see the reversion of the trend, right? At the same time, and it starts around the mid-80s. And at the same time, you see an acceleration of the R&D to sales ratio. This is Compustelle data around the same time, okay? So this is suggesting that, you know, it's brutally descriptive, suggesting that there is something going on with this convergence and stop of convergence that could be correlated, related to the policy intervention, okay? So this is what we do. We do a lot of things. It's sort of big paper. I'll try to squeeze it in the time I have. I'm gonna rush a bit, but stop me anytime you have questions. So we look at, first thing we do, we look at the welfare effects of foreign technological convergence. So in the literature on international trade, we often look at welfare effects of reduction in trade costs. So here, what we want to see is not what happens to me when the trade barriers between me and my trade partners decline. Okay, I want to see what happens to my welfare when my trade partner gets better technologically. Okay, so this is fairly unexplored, although it is a classic issue in international trade. So the welfare effects of foreign technological progress for given trade barriers. Okay, so then we are going to ask the key question. Okay, what is the welfare properties? Okay, we are going to assess the effects of increasing subsidies to innovation in a world where your partners, your trade partners, are becoming better and better. Okay, So when you're being caught up by your competitors, what are the welfare properties? Okay, what is the role? What are the effects of increasing subsidies to innovation? Then we're going to do a counterfactual. And we're going to ask, we're going to go Trump. And we're going to ask, what if instead of increasing R&D subsidies in the early 80s, the US would have increased trade barriers? Okay, we're going to compare these two policies. We're going to show winners and losers from these policies. And we're going to do optimal policy. And since we have this big dynamic model, we're going to compare the short and long run, which is something that you don't see very often in the trade literature. And it turns out to be politically very, very important. Because a lot of the adjustments that we study in classrooms, and we assume that they take place immediately, takes actually place through time. And this can be very important. And then I'm going to show you some complementarity between trade and innovation policy that is important for fiscal purposes. Okay, preview of the results. We're going to first show you some effects that are static, so in a very standard world of the standard trade theory. We're going to show you that foreign catching up is going to benefit workers but hurts firms. And protectionism is going to benefit firms and hurt workers. Then we're going to introduce dynamics, and in this model, dynamics is going to be innovation dynamics. And we're going to see that when your partner gets better and better and start converging technologically with you, your firms will be forced to innovate more. So this is going to be what Philippe calls an escape competition kicking in, together with the fact that there's going to be technology transfer. Okay, they get better, I can buy better machine from them, I get an improvement in my productivity. This is the technology transfer or the gains from trade, if you will. The second bit is, they're better, my firms have to run faster if they want to survive. This is an escape competition effect that is going to kick in and further improve my productivity. Okay? So what protectionism is going to do is going to shut down both channels of productivity growth, both the static and the dynamic. But interestingly enough, and dangerously enough, in the short run, we have 10 years, in the simulation, protectionism is good. So, and I'm going to explain why. Mostly, it protects profits and rents, okay? Which is, in the short run, helps national income. In the long run, since it's going to hamper productivity growth, because firms can sit relaxed, protected from foreign competition, and it's going to be very costly. R&D subsidies is going to be a much better policy to target foreign competition. Okay, and interestingly enough, we show that the optimal R&D subsidy, okay, is decreasing in the level of openness. So a more open economy, lower trade barriers, okay, reduce the need to subsidize R&D. This is very interesting because this means that it creates some fiscal space, okay, to do redistribution, for example, okay, which is a key issue in all these globalization debates and the globalization skepticism, right? That some people or part of the production process get hurt and they need to be compensated. Okay, so this is what we do. Now we can go to the model. So two countries, final good produced with intermediate goods that are traded and labor. Intermediate goods are structured as follows. Each intermediate goods is going to have two firms, one foreign and one domestic. Okay, but there's going to be entry in each of these sectors, okay? So firms will compete through innovation and will get global leadership and sell globally when they have the best quality of the good. Okay, so these two countries, imagine that the domestic country is the US, the foreign country is the rest of the advanced countries. Okay, this is mostly Japan and Europe in that period. Japan and the six European countries we have, plus the US, are about 98% of R&D, global R&D in those years. So these countries are going to be different initially in the early 70s, because US is going to be the technological leader. American firms are going to be leaders in most sectors of the economy. Then we're going to introduce a mechanism of convergence through knowledge spillovers, okay, that will lead Japan and other countries to converge with the US. Okay? And then we're going to analyze the properties of this convergence. So this is the model, final good, produced with a bunch of intermediate goods K of different quality Q. Okay? And these goods can be produced by country A and country B, and labor. Okay? So the firm with the highest quality intermediates will be able to sell globally, okay, provided that the quality is good enough to face also some trade costs that I'm going to introduce. In each product line J, there is going to be one firm per country competing at Bertrand. Quality is going to evolve through innovation and spillovers. Anytime an innovation arrives, there's going to be an increase in quantity of measure lambda, and firms can have, each time they innovate, theta, okay, number of jumps, and theta is going to be a random variable. Okay, so now we're departing a little bit from the standard model. I'm going to tell you a bit more about this theta. So NC is going to be the number of quality jumps up to time t. So quality at time t, okay, is lambda to the power of the number of quality jumps that a firm had until time t. So now in each sector, firms from country A and country B have a technological leadership, okay, a technology gap, and the technology gap is the difference between the number of jumps that firms from country A have experienced until time T and the jumps of the firms from country B. Okay, this M variable is the difference in jumps, okay, and it can assume many values, but we're going to cap it at M bar. Okay? Now, theta, the number of jumps, is going to be a random variable that is going to make multiple steps jumps less likely. Okay? It's harder to do 10 quality jumps compared to 2. Okay? So it's going to be increasing difficulty. But there's going to be some sort of advantage of backwardness, in the sense that backward firms that are very far away from the frontier, okay, are more likely to make multiple jumps. So this is going to help firms from the lagging country converge. So guys, if you want an intuition how convergence happens in this model, okay, is through this structure of spillovers. Okay, in the solo model, if you're backwards, you're going to converge through decreasing returns to capital accumulation. Here, you converge through decreasing returns to knowledge accumulation. Okay. So on the intermediate goods side, it's very nothing new. So intermediate goods are produced only with the final goods. We're working on a different version of the model now. Okay, they sold so they operate they solve this standard problem where eta is the cost of production in if you don't export. If you export, you need to add K, which is an iceberg trade cost. Okay, so very straightforward. You get market pricing, and the market pricing is augmented for the iceberg trade cost for exporters. Okay, and exporters and non-exporters have different profits. Now, here in a model with export, the quality difference between my firm, okay, the American firm in the product line J, and the foreign firm, there are some distance between each other, okay? So this quality distance is going to allow me to export only if my quality is sufficiently higher from yours that I can meet trade cost, okay? So after taking into account the trade cost, if my quality is still higher than yours, I'm going to export in your countries and vice versa. So there's going to be a cutoff different from the Melitz cutoff. This is going to be a quality jump cut, a gap cutoff, okay? About which firms will export, okay? So if you want an idea of these cutoffs, so H2 and F2 are the two quality frontiers of the home country and the foreign country, and this the dotted line are the quality frontiers taking into account the transportation costs. Okay, so here, okay, the home countries with the transportation cost has still higher quality than the foreign country. So this is the goods that I'm going to export. Similarly for the foreign country, this is the good that the foreign country is going to export and I'm going to import. And here there's going to be only domestic sales. Okay, so here, differently from Melitz, the cutoffs for exporting are going to be at defined by not by sheer productivity, but by the difference between my productivity and my partner's productivity. Okay, and we can do something in the data with this. Okay, so how does competition work here? So the innovation dynamics shapes competition here. So here we have different product lines with different quality difference, okay? So here the blue line is the foreign firm and the red line is the US firm. So here they're very close. So here there's very close small leadership by foreign firms, large leadership by foreign firms, large leadership by US firms. So how does competition work? Well, scenario one, okay? The US firm closes the gap, reduces the gap, but not completely. Okay. So this is the incumbent firms reducing the gap. Okay, all the incumbent firms can catch up. Okay. Third scenario, the incumbent firms can leapfrog. Okay. So here, we allow for the possibility that in this line, there's going to be an American firm that is not the incumbent, is an entrant, that is going to enter, replace the American incumbent, and do either catch up or leapfrog. Okay? So we assume that in this economy, if there is an entrant, it's going to replace the incumbent. So it's always going to be two firms per product line. Okay. Promise the last model slide, and then we're going to go to some results. So these are the value functions for an innovator in country A that is at gap M from its competitor. So it chooses optimal innovation, okay, it chooses innovation investment X in order to maximize that object. So the incentive to innovate are shaped by, first by profits, this is the first thing you see up there, and profits can be from domestic and foreign sales if you export, only from domestic sales if you're not good enough, or zero if you are a quality follower, okay? So The profit incentive is a typical market size incentive that also the paper that we saw before has. Then, if I innovate, okay, I can improve the distance. So I am a gap M. I can be a gap M plus theta from my competitors. So I innovate to stay away from competition, okay? And I can do it getting an additional a profit. So there is an incentive in this model to innovate if you are an incumbent. So this is what Philip has called the escape competition effect in a model that is generalized for many step gaps, okay? So now, if either the domestic entrants innovate, okay, or foreign firms innovate, okay, I'm going to lose something. If the domestic entrants innovate, I'm gonna be run out of business, okay? This is business stealing, this is domestic business stealing. But in this open economy, there is this international dimension of business stealing. So if Japanese firms innovate, okay, they reduce my market power. They could reduce my market power to a point where I lose my business, okay? So this is the foreign international business stealing effect. Okay, these are the main forces at play here. So finally, welfare in this economy is going to be a measure of consumption. Consumption is going to be equal to national income. National income equals profits. There's going to be some profits that I do on export sales, some profits that I do on domestic sales. Then I have to pay for the R&D cost in both type of sectors. And then these two ugly expressions here are wages. What this means is simply, so this is the domestic component of productivity and that the export component of productivity. So since I am buying intermediate goods that I couple with labor, both domestically, okay, and I import some of these intermediate machines, okay, labor productivity is going to be determined by the quality of the domestic machines and the quality of the foreign machines. Okay? So trade in this economy is going to improve or reduce the price of foreign machines and is going to benefit workers. Okay? So what are the static effects in this economy of opening up to trade? Well, it's very, we can show it very simply. For the exporters, trade is going to increase market size, okay, and increase their quality, okay, because they're going to have these larger profits. Then, since trade is going to reduce the price of foreign intermediates, this is going to increase wages, okay? But remember here, I was buying these goods from my firms, now I'm buying these goods from Japanese firms. It's good for my workers because Japanese goods are cheaper, okay, like Chinese goods are cheaper now, but all these domestic American firms shut down, okay? So trade is good for the American exporters, is bad for the American import competing industry firms, and is good, is bad for these firms and is good for workers. So there is a tension in this model, okay? There also can be a tension for workers in more complicated model between exporter and importer. Some firms that will be kicked out of business because of trade, they're not gonna be happy. Now, innovation, when you go to the dynamic effects, innovation is going to move the quality frontier. So trade is going to not only affect statically profits and wages, but also have innovation effects, okay? Through market size and competition. And I'm gonna show you exactly how. So now the model cannot be solved analytically. We go to the computer and we do the following quantitative analysis. So we start from 1975. We're gonna target a bunch of growth statistics. And then what we're going to do, we are going to generate a measure of the distribution of leadership using pattern data, and we're going to have the model reproducing that convergence that you see in the aggregate, okay? In this case, it's going to be it's going to be at the sectoral level. So this is the aggregate statistics. We match it pretty well. Not really interesting stuff going on here. This is the interesting stuff. So this is the distribution of leadership in 1975. What I mean by that? So we divide sectors into 33 bins. Okay. So bin 16 here. Okay, is this is going to be the share of sectors, okay, share of sectors where U.S. firms have more than 97% of patents. Bin 15 is going to be that point there is the share of sectors where U.S. firms have more than 94% of patents. So all bins on this side, okay, are bins where U.S. have patent majority, patent leadership. And on this side, we have bins where foreign firms have the leadership. You see that in 1975, the distribution is skewed to the right. Okay? There is a massive US leadership. Okay? Then the black line is the distribution in 1981. You see that as the aggregate, you see catching up here. More and more foreign leadership. So then we feed the model this distribution, we let the transitional dynamic of the model take place, and we see that the model, this is the dot line, matches pretty well this distribution. So this is one identification. Then very quickly, this is the distribution of innovation by incumbents, okay, across the two cutoffs. So this is the export cutoff, okay, and this is the cutoff for producing domestically. Okay? You can see that the distribution in the model is very similar to the distribution in the data. So what this figure is telling you, the firm seems to accelerate R&D just before entering the domestic market, okay, and just before entering the export market. And the reason for this is that before entering each market, you have a big market size premium, okay, that encourages firms to innovate. After that, when you secure the premium, then the competition effect of entering a new market slows down. Okay, and it's interesting that you see these twin peaks also in the data. In the trade literature, you see a lot of this, okay, but not across gaps, across productivity levels. So firms seems to innovate more, as Mattia showed, when they export. Okay, here we have a more detailed story about gaps and. All right, so quickly, the what does the model do? I have 5 minutes. Man. All right, so here we construct a counterfactual. Okay. That works as follows. So we let the transitional dynamics go, but we shut down business stealing because we want to see when foreign countries improve their technology, what's the effect on my welfare, okay? So the key mechanism here is going to be business stealing and innovation. So here what I'm going to do, I'm going to construct a counterfactual economy that shuts down business stealing, okay, and compare it with the factual economy. So when you shut down business stealing, okay, in the short run, you have some gains. Why? Well, because Japanese technology improves, but you don't let them steal your business. Okay, this is an artificial exercise. But later on, okay, there is a reversional trend. Okay, and the reason for this is essentially that in the short run, if you don't let them copying you or leapfrog you, you're going to keep your profits. In the long run, if you stop them from competing with you and stealing your markets, you're going to reduce the incentive to innovate. Okay? And this reduction of the incentive to innovate is going to lead to welfare losses because your firms can sit and relax and not be worried about foreign competition. Okay? So that's the key story. Now, when we do the policy exercise, we say, let's plug into the model the we use the increase in federal R&D tax credit. So the R&D tax credit shock that we observe in the starting from 81, so we just take an average, okay? And let's see what happens. So we want to see the effect of the US increasing R&D subsidies after 1981. So this is the effect. In the short run, for a few years, there is a cost because you have to pay. You have to tax consumers, households, to pay for this subsidy. But pretty quickly, you start getting into the positive side. So when we break down these effects, part of the gains are due to profit shifting. So what you're doing with subsidy, you're protecting the domestic economy without shutting down trade. You're basically helping firms keep their leadership and therefore keep their profits. You do profit shifting back to you, okay? And the other part is that you're increasing the incentive to innovate, okay? And this is going to benefit consumers because French firms, or American firms in that case, are going to innovate more and have a higher quality products or intermediate goods, okay? So the optimal, when we do look at the optimal R&D subsidies, is way higher than the observed one. So the US did the right thing to increase R&D subsidies, but they were shy in terms of quantity. This looks like a typical Krugman argument. You have to intervene, but you didn't intervene enough, okay? And the welfare gains that we get are a bit shy of 1% per year. So this subsidy led to an increase in consumption, an additional 1% consumption per year. The optimal subsidy gains are massively larger. Okay, now we go Trump, okay? Let's assume that the US in 1981, instead of introducing the R&D tax credit, they would increase trade barriers by 40%, okay? So, for about 10, 12 years, there are gains, and then there are losses. The gains come mostly from business stealing, okay? So US are protecting their firms, they keep their profits, national income goes up because of profits. Okay? In the long run, what happens is, first, you're basically helping unproductive US firms, okay? Replacing foreign very productive firms with US firms, you're losing. Because your workers are going to work with bad machines, low quality machines. On top of that, these US firms, they become slacker, okay? And that innovation goes down, okay? So what's happening if you want, what's happening here is basically the threshold for domestic firms to enter the market, okay, and being able to sell in the domestic market. So then this threshold switch shifts to the left. So with protectionism, you're basically allowing less productive domestic firms to survive and actually being able to sell in your market. Replacing highly productive foreign firms, and that's a loss. Okay. So protectionism gives you short-run gains, okay, because you're protecting American business, but long-run losses, both because you're giving up the opportunity to use highly productive foreign intermediate goods, and because your firms innovate less because of less escape competition. Okay, So now, the last thing I want to show you, here we compute for an horizon of 35 years, okay, the optimal.
Mario,
it's gone. I'm finished. Like, this is the last thing I'm going to. Yeah. Oh, okay. So, sorry, I thought I had still 2 minutes, but I have to be. I'll wrap up. So, last thing, and then I stop. So, we compute the optimal subsidy rate over different level of openness, okay, of trade costs. So here, reducing, so this is the benchmark. This is 1% less than the benchmark trade cost. As you see, as you reduce trade cost, optimal subsidy goes down. So the idea here is that openness provides the market with enough competition and with enough innovation incentives that you can reduce the fiscal expenditure to fund innovation, to subsidize innovation. Okay? And this is interesting because since we know that innovation can have a lot of distributional effects, okay, this model is telling you that competition and innovation allows countries to have some fiscal budget to do trade-related redistribution policies, okay, without increasing public deficit. And I am done. So sorry for run over.
For 10 minutes.
No, even less. I mean, a couple of questions. I apologize. It's a long project.